My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with one of the country's top sports presenters. We speak about his dad's national service, their relationship, and suicide. We also speak about living with depression, being honest with yourself, and protecting your family. From living under grey skies to helping others. Episode 53, John Fendley. This is Declassified. Born in 1969.
Correct, yep. Born in 1969 in Scarborough. Lived in a small place outside Scarborough for a couple of years. I don't remember, called Mouthorpe. And then moved to East Ayton, which is about 4 miles outside of Scarborough, where I lived with my mum Nancy, my father Arthur, and my sister Kathleen. I've got three other siblings. So I've got my brother Paul, my sister Christine, and my sister Sue, all from the same mother but different dad. Sue's fortunately passed away over in Australia in the last couple of years. So, yeah, working class family. Went to school in Scarborough, Raincliffe School. Just a regular kind of upbringing. Very, very, very sort of normal. On a wasn't a council estate. It was just they were council houses that. But down the line, I think at some point during the 80s, I think my mum got the right to buy the council house. So she bought that for pretty reasonable, I think.
But there was four of you growing up, and the other siblings, they're younger, are they?
No, they're older. They're older. So my mum was married to obviously my brother and my other two sisters' father. They lived in Harrogate. They were in Harrogate, and then they split up. And then my mum came to Scarborough, and met my dad.
Was it a tight family? Was you together?
The four of us, or not really. I mean, my eldest sister Sue was one of the first £10 poms, and she went out to Australia when she was about 18. And the first time she was, I don't know how old she was, but the first time I met her, my brother was in Scarborough and then went to Australia. My other sister, Chris, she lived in Scarborough. My mum was obviously the integral in the kind of port of call, the thing that brought us all together. So whenever we were all together, it would have been at my mum's, but considering my sister was out in Australia, my brother was out there a lot as well, we weren't all together as a seven, we weren't very rarely, I would say. I mean, possibly never, but
And then there was just four of you then in the house.
Your sister and your mum and dad.
What did your mum and dad do?
So my mum was generally she worked for as a housekeeper for it was Lord Derwent, who lived in Hackness just outside of Scarborough. So she was a housekeeper there. She did like cleaning jobs. She worked, she cleaned at the pub. She was on and off all kinds of, different jobs whilst keeping the house going. So
was she dedicated to her family?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But there were times when she couldn't work through ill health. So it's kind of it's sketchy in that sense to recall exactly what she was doing when she was doing it, but I know I as a kid I was taken to, you know, to Lowell, where she was the housekeeper. I spent a lot of time there. I would spend, you know, time at a pub where she would be cleaning. So when I was little, I remember being at all these different places. So,
so you spent a lot of time with your mum?
Spent a lot of time with my mum, yeah, in my formative years.
And dad, what did he do?
So my dad worked for the Yorkshire Water Authority, and he was part of a team who were responsible for cleaning out the sea cut. Do you know what's it? No. The sea cut is. So it's basically, don't know what you'd call it now. It's like it's a river that runs to the sea, basically. So it was. I don't know if it's a man-made river or not. I'd need to look into it. But he was basically responsible for the upkeep of the to make sure the water flow was all good and bridges and all that kind of stuff. Basically, he was responsible for making sure that water going from point A to point B, in which was the sea, got there.
In Scarborough?
Yes, in Scarborough. In Mouthorpe, which was where I was, where I originally lived. So he was born in a very small cottage in Mouthorpe, beautiful part of the world, near a place called Hackness. So he was born there, but where he worked was literally next door. It was almost part of the land, and I think the actual hut for when it was raining, and they had like a little coal burner in there, little log burner. And I think that was actually on my granddad's land. I think it was part of his land. So my dad was basically working, almost like weirdly sort of working from home, probably or not when he was growing up, because he'd moved to Ayton at that point. But so his like geographical heat map was very small. It would be from Mouthorpe to Ayton. And back, which was about, you know, like 3 or 4 miles. So that was his but basically his house was where he was working. Mm. His old house, and my granddad was there, you know. So
and was you close to your dad?
I was close to my dad, yeah. But I was close to him, but without being, with it being kind of maybe communicated. So I can't ever remember I can't remember sitting down and having a conversation with my dad about anything, really. I can't recall anything that we did together. I can't recall any, you know, moments where I remember doing that with my dad, but I didn't. I still look back, going, he really loved me, and I really loved him, and he was warm and he was affectionate.
Would he cuddle you and stuff?
Yeah. It was. I mean, I've always been someone who needs that physical affection, and so I was always trying to get cuddles off my mum and my dad, and.
So it was a loving household.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And so you didn't do much with your dad, but so he wouldn't take you for football.
No, he had no interest in football. He played a bit of cricket, I think, but I can't. Again, I used to play a lot of football, a lot of cricket. I don't really remember him coming to watch me play. The world was very different then. Mm. You know, it's like now, you know, if our kids are playing football or whatever, you know, you go and watch them while they're doing gymnastics. You go along, you're watching me take them there. Maybe it was the done thing then, but it wasn't for me, you know. And I was never like, oh, I really wish my dad was here watching me, you know. Or I wish my mum was here watching me. It was like, just go on with it.
Just the way it was.
Yeah.
I mean, because obviously we've had a conversation before, he would go to the pub quite a lot.
Mm.
Would you say he was like a big, would he come back pissed up or?
No, never saw him drunk. I saw him drunk once when he had stayed behind after work when the house that he used to live in, where his father, my granddad, had died, this gentleman had moved in and he was living there. My dad got to know him and he made a homebrew. So my dad used to cycle to work. I think he went on my bike at one point. He used to go on my bike. I got a bike when I was whatever how old I was, and he commandeered it and used to ride to work. Anyway, yeah, he came back one night and was drunk and was, you know, sick downstairs in the kitchen, which was just what's going on. You know, I'd never seen that. So he didn't drink in the house. It was come from work, go upstairs, have a wash, have a shave, put his shirt and tie on, put his little jacket on, and off he'd go. And he'd be in the pub from, you know, 7:30 till 10:30, whatever it was. And he'd do that most nights of the week. And then Sunday he'd go earlier and then come back for Sunday lunch. He'd always bring us a bottle of lemonade back for Sunday lunch. So yeah, I didn't see my dad drinking because I was a kid, obviously. So I didn't see him drinking. We didn't drink in the house. My mum had a brandy occasionally in the house, but
did it create problems with your mum and dad? The kind of drinking, being out.
Yeah, it did, but it was. I don't think it was the being out. You know, again, I've never had a conversation. I never got around to having that conversation with my mum about how she felt that my dad was at the pub a lot. But the problem stemmed from the fact that my dad would get his wage packet and he'd bring it home. Literally, you know, you had the little brown envelope with your pay slip in, and he'd give my mum whatever it was. Let's say my dad earned 100 quid and he'd give mum 75, probably 80, and then he'd have the other. That was on a Thursday. But by Monday, he'd spent his money. But my dad could never go, do you know what? I'm not going to go out this night. I'm going to save that money because I don't want this pattern to continue. He never took responsibility for that. So come Monday, he would be asking my mum for money. But he wouldn't be demanding or aggressive or anything like that. He reverted into being almost like a small child. So it became like almost like a son talking to his mother. You know, please can I, please Nancy, you know, I need to, come on, just lend us a tenner or lend us whatever, you know. So, and that would cause friction, that would cause problems because my mum's like, well, you know, we need that money for the housekeeping, you know. Mm. And then, so I've got to then find, if I give you this, and this pattern.
And you'd be seeing
continued.
That,
yeah, I would see that and hear it, and it was like, and it was a dread, like, oh, it's going to happen. It's going to kick off because it's going to be, things are getting thrown and people are, you know, swearing at each other. It was never that. It was just like, I felt for my mum, I felt she's got to deal with that and it was upsetting her. So I was very protective of my mum. Why, you know, she was having to cope with that and it was causing her anxiety and causing her stress. But it just kind of continued, you know, and it was Groundhog Day, basically.
Did he have trauma in his childhood or in his early life? Why would it, do you feel like, let me rephrase it a little bit, was he, It's kind of a two-parter, mate, really. Would you think he was... Did he think he had an alcohol problem? Do you think he was kind of medicating against, like, a trauma?
Quite possibly. I think he certainly had trauma when he was in the forces, which, again, never spoke to him about and only found out about it retrospectively, which was when he was doing his national service and he was abroad. I don't exactly know where, but I think he was in Germany. And he was supposed to get on a truck of with his friends, the soldiers, and it went over a bridge and it went off the bridge and they all died. And I'm led to believe that he felt like he obviously had a big effect on him because he lost friends, colleagues, but that he that sort of survivor's guilt. Yeah. I don't know if that's what they call it, but as a kid, I didn't really know about that, and it was only retrospectively that I found out about it. You know, so I would, and I can't imagine he really got any counselling. I mean, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have had any counselling about that. He'd probably just got, you know, they had to get on with it. And aside from that, I don't know of any other, not that, you know, you need anything more than that, but so it may have been that was a part of it. But aside from that, I wouldn't know of any other instances within his life. I know that he had, with his treatment, I know that there were, there were problems with his treatment for his depression. With he had an electric shock therapy, which he basically had to be resuscitated from.
Mm. Let's get to that in a sec. Just talk about your schooling then, and just a little bit about your childhood. Was you happy as a kid growing up, you know, at 10, 11 years old?
I was. I always was happy, and I loved sport. I loved football. I loved cricket. I got on well with everyone at school. I was fine. You know, it was quite a nice school. I played football. I was captain of the football team, so you know there were any issues, really. There weren't any issues. I think when I look back, what I realised is I spent a lot of time on my own, and I also spent a lot of time not at home. I probably spent a lot of time at my auntie's, which in a nearby village, because one of my parents were in hospital, with mental health issues. So they were either in Clifton Hospital in York or in, there's one on the seafront in Scarborough, I can't remember what it's called now, or another one, Cross Lane. So when I think back on it, well, that took place. I was at my auntie's then. And so I spent, and I love my auntie, you know, it wasn't a problem, but it was, you go into your auntie's. And now I think back, it was probably because my mum and dad were having issues, or my dad was poorly, and my mum was poorly.
Did you ever notice that? There was, and I don't know what the issues were, but did you ever notice that your mum and dad were kind of not in good health?
Yeah, I'm not.
Psychologically?
Yeah, my dad would be very withdrawn, very, become quite sort of timid, and didn't really see him crying, but I did see him crying, but not a huge amount. My mum, more so, my mum would get very, I knew when my mum was poorly, you know, I could see she was, you know, she was in a bad way. She was at the end of a tether, and yeah, hard to kind of say. Oh yeah, she was just, you know, they were just depressed. You know, they were just in and out of depression and lived with depression, I think. And got better and managed it for a bit and then fell back into it. And yeah, it was, but a lot of the time I think I was probably taken out of the equation, so I didn't have to see it.
Did you ever go to hospital?
I never went to Clifton in York. I think I went to see Mum in Cross Lane, but I mean, that was probably in later life. The one on the seafront in Scarborough, I think, what's that called? Is it called St. Thomas's or something like that? I remember going there to see her. But I think I was probably, the reason I was probably at my auntie's was because it wasn't a great environment for me to be in. But I do think back to things that I, when I talk to my kids about things, and I remember I developed a really bad twitch, like blinking, really, really bad blinking. And I also used to twizzle my hair around when I had hair. I used to twizzle my hair around there and pull it in knots, and I'd pull it out, and I had like bald patches here.
When you was a kid?
Yeah. Yeah, at my auntie's, I remember that. And I also had a fear of going to sleep. So I'd get up in the morning and I'd get to lunchtime in the afternoon. I'd be sitting there, I'd be thinking, I'm really scared about going to sleep tonight. Okay, because I'm not going to be able to sleep. And that's a fear that a lot of kids probably have, but it was bad. And I struggle with sleep. I always wanted to get into bed with my mum or my dad, even when I was, even up to the age of about 14, probably. I really struggled with it. And now I look back, I can go, well, the reason for that is probably because, you know, you weren't probably having the best of times, and you were struggling a bit, maybe psychologically, but...
Well, safety as well, and being vulnerable, maybe.
Yeah, but I never like felt like when I was at my auntie's that anything, you know, I always felt things were going to be all right, you know, as like as you do as a kid, I suppose. You know, I was always loved. I wasn't ever, you know, left, you know, I was always loved, and I always had, you know, as much as it was available. But I think when I look back, there was a lot of time that I was probably on my own. And I still feel like I'm a bit like that. I whether it's because I was, or I need that time to myself.
Which is two sides then, because early on you said you wanted the physical and the connection.
Yeah.
But also time to yourself. Do you think a lot? Are you a thinker?
Yeah, I'm an overthinker. Yeah, absolutely.
So an overthinker?
Yeah.
So you'd... And was you, as a kid, was you an overthinker?
Yeah, I think the stuff like the worrying about sleeping and those kind of things, you know, were quite pervasive thoughts, and my overthinking was, it's never really, it's been more of a problem as I've got older, I think. For me, generally, the real life stuff that I have to deal with, I can generally cope with that all right, or I think I've been able to cope with it all right. But it's just then sometimes when you're not at your best, or you for whatever reason, you know, you might have a thought that comes in, you start thinking about that, and it's generally things that you can't really effect. So it might be stuff in the past that's happened, and you start thinking about, you know, like sliding doors and that kind of stuff, which again, I think probably a lot of people think about. Just some days it becomes a bit like it's there all the time. You're thinking about this stuff and you're trying to get on with your day-to-day stuff, but it's taking up energy, you know.
1986, your dad died. Mm. He's 53.
Yeah.
Do you remember the knock at the door?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember the knock at the door, and it was my next door neighbour who my mum did not like at all. She didn't get on with her at all. And she knocked at the door. My mum was upstairs. And she told us. So she didn't say, I need to speak to your mum. She told me and my sister. And I knew as soon as I saw she was with the police. And I think she might have even said it. I can't remember exactly whether the policeman said it or whether she said it. Didn't really need to say it. And I expected it was going
to... Was he in hospital?
He was in hospital, yeah. He was in hospital when it happened, yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt?
I felt there's a little part of me that was like, it was like a relief, some of it. And that's a terrible thing to say. But, because I was so sure that something was going to happen, it was almost like I can sort of, there might be a bit of peace. There might be peace for my mum. You know, I'm peace from my dad, because I just felt it was going to happen. He'd said it was going to happen. So, yeah, I think after that, things probably just... I'm sure you probably just go into some sort of state of shock, although you don't feel like you're in shock. You just feel like you're dealing with it, because, you know, you're finding out, you know, you're finding stuff out, you're finding out details, and you... if I'm brutally honest, that was how I felt. I felt a bit of, it's done, you know. It's done, and it's horrible, you know. It's horrible, but it certainly wasn't, oh my God, I can't believe this has happened.
It wasn't out of the
blue. It certainly wasn't. For me, it wasn't. Of course, it's a shock still, but it wasn't. It wasn't a surprise to me.
Was there any embarrassment?
No. Absolutely not. No.
What about school?
No one spoke to me about it. No one talked about it.
Did you ever speak as a family about it?
No.
Did you ever speak about your dad?
Not really. Not with my mum. No. I can't remember sitting down having a conversation where we got round and we sat down and we went, you know, and I'm 16 and I'm, you know, I'm, your brain, it finds a way to cope, I think. So I went to school. I think I went to school the next day. Can't remember what day of the week it was. I feel like it was like a... can't remember what day. But I definitely went to school. And you know what, kids are gonna, you know, kids are allowed by, but not gonna, what they're gonna say. They're gonna come up to you and go, you know, hey mate, do you want to have a chat? You know, and how
some
been?
Kids can be vicious, but yeah, it sounded like you had friends.
Yeah,
and...
no, I mean, no, nothing. There was nothing bad. There was nothing good. My form teacher, a guy called Terry Hobson, he pulled me and he said, "How are you? All right, you know, if you need anything." But you know, the school didn't, you know, to my knowledge anyway, the school didn't do anything to. But that, again, I wasn't going home going, I can't believe the school. I'm having, you know, it, you know, you just got on with it. You know,
there was no self pity.
No, absolutely not. Never has.
Did you cry? Did you grieve?
No,
your dad.
I didn't cry. I didn't cry really. I probably had a little cry, but I didn't. You know, crying came later down the line. But I didn't. I feel that was probably a problem. You know, when my mum died a couple of years ago, it was a very natural grieving process. Horrible at the time. And some of the worst days of my life, but it that felt like a natural grieving process. I didn't have that with my dad for whatever reason. I wasn't upset.
Do you think you'd grieved before? I don't know if I'm putting words into your mouth, but just as you're saying, you know, because there was a love but a disconnect, you know.
Yeah, I hadn't grieved before. No, I don't think I was.
Did you know what suicide was?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was 16. You know, I was a smart, you know, I was a smart kid, you know. So I've always been very in touch with my emotions, and I've never been afraid to show my emotions, or to talk about stuff either, you know. So, and it wasn't like I was a closed book and I was shut off and I didn't want to talk about it. It was just that nobody had gone, you know, going to fancy a brew, mate, you know, and it's just the way it was, you know. But I never felt sorry for myself. Felt, you know, I was sad, but I felt like it was a terrible thing to say, but you know, it's just honestly how I felt. It felt like there was, it for my mum, I felt my mum now could, it was that hard for her, but I felt it was a burden removed from her a little bit, and it might allow her to live her life in a different way. Because to an extent, she was mothering her husband, ultimately, you know, so.
3 years later, you started feeling different. You started feeling low.
Yeah.
Where did it come from?
Well, I was in a relationship with this girl and everything was fine and it was good now. And I was planning to go to Australia. And I was working at B&Q part time, and my mum was like, you need some work. My mum was like, because if my dad was poorly and didn't work, she would be like, Arthur, come on, you've got to pull yourself together. And if he, you know, he wasn't working because he didn't feel well mentally, didn't want to go to work and miss time. She was paranoid that I would become like that. She was worried that I was going to be, you know, not tough enough emotionally, you know, and psychologically to go out there and do it and, you know, get a job and do all those kind of things. So she was like, you know, go out and get a job. You know, this was sort of in between school and college and stuff. So I went to, they were setting up a store in Grantham, And I didn't know any of these people there. And I was a bit, you know, it's only in Grantham, but I was a bit homesick and I was missing my girlfriend. And this lad said, this lad, like, he said something to me and it was quite an aggressive, he was basically kind of sort of saying, move that thing, get out of the way sort of thing, you know. And it was like, because I was probably feeling a bit homesick and whatnot, and it was like, it sort of really, it upset me, you know, more like, on a normal day, it was just being like, but I was quite a sensitive individual. I got really upset, and that actual one thing then sparked like a domino effect of me. I got really panicky, got nervous, got anxious, started crying, wanted to go. So when we went back for the weekend, because it was like a month-long job, whatever, but we were going back to Scarborough each weekend, I remember driving back in the car out with the boss who was driving back to Scarborough, and it was pitch black, and I can remember that I had the radio on and I felt awful, I felt dreadful, it was like a 3-hour panic attack, how long it took to get back, 3-hour panic attack, and I got home and I went to see my girlfriend and I felt all right, but I was like, I'm not going back there, I'm not doing that. And then I had this, and then I started working at this, again, my mum was like, you need to go, come on, you need to work, you need to do this thing, get yourself a job, get yourself, you know, don't be sitting around at home. So I got this job at a garden centre, and it was all these raspberry plants, like acres of massive raspberry, and it was literally just tying them together. So walking around these fields, and it was early November or early December, and it was drizzling and it was horrible, and it was just, again, you know, it sort of was adding, it was exacerbating, and I knew I was going to Australia, and I was like, and then I had this moment where, like, my girlfriend, I was like, we were really close. We got on really well, and then I had this like feeling that, you don't love her, and it was like, I wasn't in control. It was like an anxiety attack, like a massive anxiety attack, because it was like this person that I really cared about. It was like my part of my brain was going. And it was more about the why is this happening? You know, it wasn't so much about, I was obviously upset by the feeling, but it was like, do I feel like this? Is what's happening here? You know, and then it basically, everything just kind of spiraled, and I went home, and from that point then I was just kind of breaking down. And when I look back on it, I feel that it was because of my dad. You know, it was nothing, the way I look at it, I don't know. When I look back on it, it's like, it wasn't to do with my relationship with that girl. It was about everything that had preceded it, I think. I don't know, and I'll never know. But there was a lot of stuff that I'd was kind of carrying with me, I think, that needed, and that was the moment, two sort of really innocuous things, but then it led to me being, you know, pretty unwell for quite a long time, you know.
It sounds like there's a compound effect as well. It's not, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back kind of thing. You know, it's not just one thing. This is lots of things that have compounded, and quite a big thing actually. Especially as you're going from, you're 16 to 19, you're becoming a man, and everything that comes with that. I was chatting to a mate of mine yesterday who released a music album 5 years ago, and we're talking about the words, you know, living under grey skies. And we were chatting about that, literally being from the north.
Yeah.
And but metaphorically as well. And it sounded like you were kind of in a bit of a both situation there, you know, this drizzle and the physical environment, all the psychological environment as well.
I could take a snap portrait of that, how it looked and how I felt. It was grey, it was horrible, it was cold, and I could hear the big pylons. It was quiet, but you could hear like the electricity sort of crackling through the pylons, and I just went, you know, it was a very, very strange, very, but I was just desperate. I just was desperately anxious, unhappy, couldn't, you know, crying. And it was overwhelming. It was just like, I just want to curl up and not curl up and die. You know, I just want to
escape.
I just want to, yeah, I just need to not be here in this place and not feel like this. And I didn't really know what was happening. It hadn't happened before, you know, so it was really scary.
It must have been confusing as well.
It was confusing, and because I never made a connection with my dad. It was only later on that people went, well, it was maybe to do with that. You know, it might have been to do with that. And then I sort of go, all right, well, maybe it was. And, but I went to Australia, on the New Year's Day.
Just 2 months after.
I went to the doctors, and the doctor said, you know, you shouldn't really go, you know, you're not in a fit state to go. But I didn't really want to go, but I was like, I feel like I've got to go, you know, I feel like I need to go. And I mean, it was madness, really. I got on the plane. I remember getting on the plane, and I was, you imagine someone sobbing inconsolably. I was sat on a plane and I cried all the way. I went with my mate, God bless him, you know, and he must have thought, Christ, you know, I'm looking forward to this trip. And, you know, I was inconsolable. I got to Australia, I was inconsolable. My sister, God bless her, she just took care of me. She just was like, come on, right, well, let's, you know, not tough love. She was just, let's get you out and about. And, I'd go off into, you know, she'd set me off, we'd do stuff. And but it was just coming out of me. It was just the crying. It was just like,
what, how long did it last for? A couple of days, a couple of weeks?
No, yeah, weeks. You know, and it they'd get better, you know, and then, but then it would.
Would you be like,
oh yeah,
hysterically crying? Like,
yeah,
sobbing?
I mean, I'd be sobbing. Yeah, I wouldn't be hysterically crying, but I'd be
tears coming down your
face.
Yeah,
yeah.
In just, public?
Yeah, in public. And no, not sat on a train, crying, and my sister's just cracking on, you know, she's getting on, and it's like, it was very strange, and it was just coming out. I was still, as I got a bit better, I started playing football. There was a football team in Balmain, and it was a decent standard, because I was playing county football at that point. You know, I was a decent-ish footballer. So I was playing at a pretty good level, and I'd started playing, and I went and played for this team, and it was boiling hot day. And I think I might have started taking some antidepressants whilst I was out there. But I remember being out on this pitch, and it was boiling, obviously Australia, and I was just like, this is like an out-of-body experience. And then I just started... I started just crying on the pitch, and I came off, and at halftime I sat in the dressing room, and there's all these blokes who I don't know any of them, because I'm just a new lad who's turned up, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just sobbing and after my sister up and say, can you come pick me up?
Did you care what other people thought?
No, I was past all that. It happened before I went. I was playing football for the village team, and I just started crying on. I just broke down just during the game whilst I'm playing. But I had no, I absolutely wasn't bothered about what people thought of me. I was like past that, really. Do you know what I mean?
At that point, had you ever thought about? Had you ever thought about kind of ending it?
No, never.
So even when you were as low as
yeah,
as this,
no.
You'd always wanted to be on the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, I never thought about that. Never thought about that. Which, you know, so I know that whatever my dad was going through was probably a very different thing, you know. So yeah, I think about it in the sense that my dad, like, I'm 52 now. My dad died when he was 53, and it's coming up, you know. And I'm like going, oh God, you know, like, and I still feel young, and I've got loads to, you know, live for, and but it like goes, wow. I think, God, that's young. It's really young.
It's bloody hard to put yourself in that situation as well, you know, that where suicide's the way. It's a bloody hard thing.
My take on it is that if somebody's at that level, if somebody's at that point, that's your only solace. That's your only way to end whatever's going on. You know, I can't imagine what my dad was going through. I just wish I could have had a conversation with him at some point. I wish I could have talked to him about it. And you know, and even afterwards, I never really talked to anyone about what was he, you know, what was making you feel like that? What was it that was making you feel like that? And what was, how did it feel? How did it feel?
I want to keep, we've moved off, but I want to stay there for a second, mate. And do you ever fantasize about having a conversation with your dad now?
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, yeah.
As a 52-year-old.
Yeah. I'd love to go and have a pint with him. Love to sit and have a chat and feel I didn't know him, you know. Feel like I didn't know him. You know, although I have affection for him but I think about how I am with my kids. You know, I see him every day. Talk to him every day, sit down with him every day, have meals with him every day, drop him off here, there, or wherever, go on holiday together. It's like I'm a big part of their lives, and I think, and they love me, and I love them. But even though my dad didn't do any of those things, I still loved my dad. But again, I don't feel, oh God, I feel cheated. None of that. I'd be lying if I said that. It. Your experience is your experience, but I just think it would have been. Imagine if it had been 2 years later, and I was a bit more. Imagine if it was me now. I could sit and go to him, like, Dad, come on, we're gonna get this sorted. You know, we're gonna get you help, you know, what do you need? What can we do? Let's sit and talk about it. You know, God, fucking hell. Imagine that. Imagine if you could have made a difference. I couldn't have done anything at the time. I couldn't have done anything.
It's empathy is such a, I think you develop it as you get older. You know, this being very empathetic. Because at that time, 19 years old, 20 years old, John, you're going, was it depression?
Yeah. I think it was.
Was you medicated and diagnosed with depression?
They said, they didn't think I was depressed. They said it was like an anxiety kind of reaction to circumstances. I definitely became depressed through it at some stages.
What other symptoms did you have? You know, when you were 19, 20 in Australia? That weren't related to the medication. Sorry, just, you know, this.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to kind of say, really. It was just a lack of... The crying and it was the biggest part of it, weirdly. It just went on forever, and I just felt sad. I just felt really sad, and like I didn't really want to do anything, you know. It did get better the longer I was out there. You know, it got better. So it was like I had to kind of go through it, and then I started feeling better. Whether that was due to the... I can't remember how long I took the medication for.
Was you gradually getting better, or was one day did you wake up?
It was really weird. I was definitely gradually getting better and feeling like I was becoming more like my old self. And I remember walking down the steps out of the house, and the sun was shining, and I had this wave of like euphoria that came over me, weird, really weird. And it was the first time in probably 6 months or whatever that I'd felt this, you know, that like adrenaline sort of happiness, that
like a joy.
Yeah. You know, it's really weird because I take antidepressants now, and I think antidepressants, they've definitely helped me, but I think you know, probably not right getting into this now, but I think that they take off a little bit either side, you know, so they take off a little bit of that, all that worry, all that overthinking, they reduce a bit of that for me, personally speaking. But I also think they take off a little bit of the other bit as well, like that kind of guttural joy, adrenaline, kind of unabashed joy, happiness. They just dull the edge of that a little bit. I don't know if anyone, you know, I don't know if you you probably know more about that than me. You know, in terms of, like, you know, antidepressants. But this day, it was, and I remember I went down to the pool. I can remember swimming under the water, and I felt this elation, and it was odd, it was weird, and and then I came back to Scarborough, and I was probably maybe looking forward to coming back at some point, you know, and I was sort of thinking about going again, and maybe I was going to go to college and stuff. So my life was probably going in a better direction than it had been, you know. So that was probably part to do with it as well. It didn't just stop there. Though. I certainly had a lot of issues about my feelings, about how I felt about people, things, you know, with relationships. I would always be doubting myself and like struggling to commit to things with relationships, because I was worried that I was gonna have that like bombshell moment again, which was gonna.
What kind of relationships with a girl or with friends?
Yeah. Well, my wife who I'm with now, Kate. So we met at college in 1990.
After Australia,
I'd come back and I met her in the first day, and after a couple of months, we were together. But for the first sort of 10 years of our relationship, and we'd been together all that time, but I was just like shit boyfriend, would let her down, would make her feel insecure, would overshare my feelings, like I'm not sure how I feel about things at the moment, and it caused problems for us, you know. Thankfully now it's like I've worked through that, you know. It was my thing. It wasn't ever a problem with our relationship, really. I think it was my issue, you know. And it was partly because of the way things had maybe ended last time with my previous relationship. I was just panicking. I was like, God, I don't want that to happen again, you know. And so I don't know.
But was it focused on you? Were you selfish at this point?
Yeah, very selfish, very 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 selfish. And if you asked her, she would say, I probably still am a bit selfish, but I'm a lot more comfortable now with me, how I am. She knows what I'm like. I'm definitely a lot more considerate, and I express myself a lot more, and I'm not worried about how she might react if I say, I feel a bit like this, you know. She's not gonna judge me. She sort of understands what I'm like now.
What's your relationship with what's your relationship with being a husband? You kind of touched on it a bit there, but also a dad. What do you feel is your responsibility in that respect? Right now.
Trying to make enough money to get them through everything they need to get through. No, I don't know. I mean,
Can I put it in context then?
Yeah.
Can I put some context to
it?
Because about three years ago, I don't know if you remember, I was sat at your kitchen table. We were discussing some of this stuff.
Right.
And you said, I want to protect my kids. I don't want to talk. I said, oh, do you want to come on?
Right, okay, yeah.
You wanted to protect your kids then.
Yeah. So I hadn't spoken to my kids about what happened with my dad and me growing up, purely because I didn't think they were old enough to, because when you get information, then the next step is you want to find out, you want to know what happened and this, that, and the other, but I didn't feel like they were old enough to deal with that. And then, but I also felt a little bit like, well, you're saying, John, that you want to talk about things, and you know it's important for people to talk about this stuff, but you're not actually doing it yourself. So I felt a bit, I was conflicted. So I sat down and I said, I'm going to do an interview, and I'm going to probably talk about my dad, and need you to know that my dad took his life. So that, and they were absolutely fine with it. And as soon as I'd done that, then it was never a problem for me to talk about it, ever, never has been. As you can tell, I'm really comfortable talking about it, about him, about how I feel about things. It was that was really the only reason. And there was maybe a little bit of me not wanting to people to judge me in the sense that they go, oh, look at him. Look at him getting on the mental health bandwagon. You know, look at him. Trying to get a bit of clout by talking about this stuff, you know, and because I'm sure there are probably people who do think that. But there was never any agenda of me sitting down talking about it. I didn't actually think that it would be particularly interesting for people. And then when I sat and I did the interview with Panonera, I realised that actually, when I read it, it's like, it's quite a, you know, you wouldn't say you sit and enjoy reading it, but it has an effect on you when you read it, I think. But I hadn't set out to go, oh, this is what I'm going to do, and this is my, it was literally just an account of my, you know, formative years, really. And then, you know, what's gone since then, and now sort of people perceive you. I think we touched upon that, but that's a slightly different tangent, but it's all part of it, I suppose.
Yeah, and it sounds like you are very much, you know, there's the right thing at the, you know, 3 years ago, but now you probably are protecting your kids more now by speaking about this and being very open about it. And because you're I suppose you are in the public eye, you've been hosting Soccer AM for about 7 years, and that even if you look at that sphere, that kind of, what's the word, that demographic, the football is very macho. It's quite often suppressed with emotion. People don't want to, especially like footballers, don't want to talk about stuff because then they get chants, you know, there's things that can be used against them.
Yeah.
And which is why I'm just kind of, again, you're referring to what people think, but in the same breath, mate, there'll be people that, or there might be one person, or there might be several, that see something and hear something and read it, and then that changes their life. And you couldn't do it with your dad. You couldn't have that conversation with your dad, but you're having a conversation now which might affect someone else's dad because of the your platform. And I know you don't want to use like that word, that platform, but actually people do look at you and see you, and they see you as this funny guy who's a great presenter and gives people joy on a Saturday morning. But there is a lived life, you know, that you have experience through living. Go on, mate.
I think doing that interview is the one thing that I, if you said, oh, what have you done in your life that, you know, you're not proud of, but that to me has been probably the most important thing that I've done, because the reaction I got from it, I didn't really expect to get that. I thought I'd get a few people going, oh, read your article, good stuff, mate. But for example, today I got a message yesterday. So I wrote that article whenever, I didn't write it, sorry. I did that interview over 2 years ago now, is it? Anyway, I got a message yesterday from a lad. I'm struggling. I don't know, he's had a bereavement, he's having relationship issues. I don't know what to do. I know you've been through that sort of thing. Can you help me, basically? And I got so many of those messages from people, and I was like, they were going, oh, you're really brave. You know, you're really brave speaking about it. And the reality is, for me, I never saw it as brave. I don't see it as brave, because I'm open to talking about how I feel. But what I realise is that even though these lads look the same as me, dress the same as me, they're into the same things as me, they're not, for whatever reason, there's a bottleneck when it comes to talking about how they feel about stuff, be it with their friends, their partners, whoever. And I realised I did realise they will actually send me a message and talk to me.
Mm.
You know, maybe before they talk to their partner or their parents or whatever. Young kids as well. And I realised it is important. It is important. And I realised that it's hard sometimes because, you know, you often I don't really know how I can help apart from give them the time, you know. But there is a lot of that. It's toxic masculinity. I kind of describe it as in it's like that. Maybe not toxic. That's a different thing. People not being comfortable talking about these things for whatever reasons, and that sort of surprises me. But maybe it shouldn't, because it's only because I'm comfortable. Like, you know, you're comfortable about talking about these things, and I don't feel embarrassed about anything that I've done or said. And but as soon as you realise, I think that people have a shared experience, however unique you in your brain think that experience is, I can't talk about this because, you know, they're not going to understand, because, you know, this is weird what's going on in my head here. This is strange. And like, and then someone goes, oh yeah, God, I get that all the time.
Mm.
People, you know, we were talking about PTSD and talking about like the reception area. Remember that?
Mm. Right. Yeah.
And I said to people, I didn't nick your analogy, but I used the reception area for me. I kind of wrote about the fact that on a good day, I thought, I'll go into the reception area and then it'll just be in there, but it won't get into the venue.
Yeah.
But on a bad day, it'll get in, you know. It's like bouncers, you know, you've got security on the door and the bad eggs are coming in, you know, and on a good day, when for whatever reason you're feeling great, you know, it doesn't bother you. But then on a bad day, you know, they sneak in, they've changed the jacket, you know, they've got in, and then they go in and they cause havoc.
The brain's protecting itself on some days and it's not protecting itself on others.
And then what I learned from it, you know, was, again, slightly gone off piece, but what I gleaned from it was trying not to fight all the time, trying to fight, trying to work it all out, trying to think it through, thinking you'll solve the puzzle, when the puzzle isn't solvable. Because what'll happen is, you haven't solved the puzzle, you go to bed next morning, you wake up and you feel all right, and you go, well, I didn't even solve the puzzle, so what was the old point? So it's for me, it's with feelings, it's letting them come, absorbing them, and not worrying or feeling bad about having a feeling, because I can't do anything about that feeling. If I feel it a particular way, you know, there might be extenuating factors, but I'm going to have feelings, whatever they are. Mm. And it's how I cope with them. And I cope with my feelings a lot better now, in terms of I don't beat myself up. I'm a lot kinder to myself about how I feel about stuff. And that's what I sort of say to people. But going back to, doing that, for me was an important thing for me to do. And I've realised, and it's not false modesty and going, oh, you know, I didn't really, you know, I didn't think too much about what I was doing, but Sky ran it as well. And so, more people got to see it. And I do think there is something to be had, you know, for social media, in the sense that somebody can message me and I can have a conversation with them, and if I make them feel a little bit better. Lads, you know, lads have gone to me I read your article. It said, you described everything that I'm feeling that I haven't been able to work out for myself. You've described it, and I've just sat down with my wife and I've had a conversation with her for the first time in 10 years about how I'm feeling, and I feel so much better, John. Like, you know what I mean? It's that's again, it's just
it's actually
like,
quite often I can't remember what the slogan was now, but it was something like it's okay to talk, right? Which is fine. But sometimes people need to listen and read before that, and then they can take action. So giving people permission to do something where they didn't think it was going to help them, or they felt scared to do it. So let's say this, for example, we listen, then we create an action, something happens. And one of the actions for you was a pivotal moment, and it was that article. But there's another pivotal moment, and for many people who are going on suffering, whatever it is, addiction, depression, an OCD, whatever it is, and it is formal therapy, because we can have therapeutic activities. We chatted before, playing the guitar is a therapeutic activity for you. Going for a run is a therapeutic activity. Combat sport, therapeutic activity. Painting, the same. But professional counselling and therapy is what made you take that step? And this was 2019, was it?
This, I think it was around then, yeah. It was pre-COVID. I got to a point where my mum had passed away, and that was really hard. That hit me really hard. And my sister had passed away a couple of months prior to that. She was an Australian and had cancer, so she died out in Australia. And then my mum was, you know, my mum was old, but I think that probably was a factor, you know, in accelerating mum's passing. Then a few months later, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was kind of getting on with everything, because I felt like, well, I'm all right with this stuff, you know. I felt like I was generally coping and doing all right, but I think I just got to a point where I'd stop doing everything that I was doing. I'd just kind of stopped functioning, really. I was just working. And I didn't want, I was worried about going to talk to someone, because I was like, of where I was feeling, I was like, I didn't want to be told, you know, well, this is your feeling because of this or that or that. But I sat down with Kate and we just decided, well, I said, I'm going to go and see someone. And my sister-in-law's a GP, and she was like, you should go and have some CBT. So I went and got some CBT, and I was a bit sceptical. I'm going to sit and talk, and like, how long is it going to be?
So talking therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this, she described it as she said, look, it's like a three-legged stool, and if one of the legs isn't right, then, you know, the stool's going to fall over. And so she kind of laid it out in pretty simple terms, which was, you've got your work, you've got your other things away from work that you need to do within your life, like cooking, doing your banking, cleaning up around the house, those sort of things. And then you've got the stuff that you enjoy, which for me would be going to football, listening to music, going to gigs, that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, what? So, you know, if I do my accounts, I don't know, if I cook a meal, you know, it's going to make me feel better, is it? And she said, what you haven't got is I didn't have the structure. I didn't have that structure. So she said, what we'll do is write out this week what you're going to do. But write out. So I wrote it down. Actually, she physically made write it out. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to work. And then I'm going to do that on. I'm going to play football on the Tuesday night. And then you're going to cook on the Thursday. You're going to cook on the Thursday. And I realised that when I was doing these other things like your banking or cleaning up or cooking, it gave me a different feeling. It gave me a different sense of, it felt like I'd done something, and it made me feel good about myself, and it felt like it gave me more of a purpose within the house. And then I made sure I went to a match, or I made sure I went to a gig. And so, and because Kate was understood what I was doing, and I still say to her now, she'll be laughing if she listens to this. If I say, I'll do that. She'll be like, I'll do it. Not because I necessarily want to do it at the moment, but I need to do it because I know once I've done it, it'll make me feel better about myself, because it just did. And it was strange because it really made sense. So for me, those things were really, I still go back to those, and I do a lot more, weirdly, I do a lot more things around the house, and I try and do a lot more of that everyday kind of stuff. It's not work, but it's not like socialising and stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah.
It's also about connecting with purpose and meaning and feeling like you're part of, you're contributing, I think,
yeah.
Maybe. That's what it sounds like, and you're being productive in different ways, not just putting all your eggs on one, you know, or not just sitting on one leg of the stool.
Yeah, yeah. It was like I'm going to work I'm coming home, but I was like, I'm working, and I was just coming home, but I wasn't engaging, really. And I think that was the big sign of that. I was depressed. I wasn't really engaging with my kids. I was just sort of there, but I wasn't really there in the moment. You know, by doing those things, it allows me to feel more part of everything, and also feel like I'm also accomplishing things apart from work, you know, which you sort of do that, don't you, anyway.
And how many sessions did you go for?
I went for about eight, I think. Eight weeks, or 6 or 8 weeks.
They say like 6 is a good number for stuff like that. 6 is a good number. You know, you've got to give it time. You've got to give it enough time.
Yeah. By I think about 4 weeks, I was going in feeling a lot better. And what was good as well for me is once you make it official, like you say to your wife or your family, I'm going to have some counselling, it's like, oh, it's official, that. So it means that then when you talk about it with them, it's like, oh, this is part of it now. I'm going to tell you how I feel. It takes pressure off those conversations, because do you understand that? Yeah. So,
but it's exposed, isn't it? It's the vulnerabilities out there.
Yeah.
That is not weaknesses.
Yeah.
Holding it in, bottling it, don't do anything. Yeah. I always think that is weakness, because you're exposing yourself. Whereas if you're vulnerable, you can be very, very strong, but you lay your vulnerabilities out, and that's where you grow and develop. It's just popped in. I don't know if it's the right thing to say. It's kind of a bit, but your dad dying Well, sorry, you look at nurture and nature, where you're always kind of destined to go up and down with your psychological health. I don't know, but...
I don't know. So my wife's always saying, oh, she's like me, she's like you. And I'm like, well, are they? I don't know. Does it... That was my first feeling. That was my first thought when I was a kid, when my dad died. We went in to see the doctor. I don't know whether my mum was going to see the doctor, but I sat down with the Dr. Spence and we were like, am I going to be like my dad? Am I going to be like my dad? And they were like, he was like, no, it's not, there's no reason why you will be, or, you know, or, so don't know. You need to speak to people who are, you know, eminently more, able to talk about this sort of thing. But I think if you grow up around it, does it affect you? I don't know. I don't know. I think if you've got a brain and a central nervous system, you know, you mental health, you know, you have mental, you have mental health of some sort. Whether your mental health is amazing and you never have any issues, or whether it's the other end of the scale, but it exists. This is what I think. You know, like you have a heart that beats. You know, you have lungs that help you to breathe. You know, you have got and to a lesser or greater extent, they work really well or not so well. So I don't know whether experiences, because your mum and dad met in psychiatric hospital, does that mean that you're going to be susceptible to suffering with mental health? You know, does this mean that, I'm going to go down the same route as my dad? No, I don't think so.
Do you think you've learned lessons? Do you think you're stronger because of what happened when you were 16? All around that area?
Yeah. I think as you get older, you experience more in life. Your priorities change, and you work out what's important. And I'm 52 now, you know. I know you're sitting here looking at me going,
No way.
Yeah, I know.
51, maybe.
Don't tell my bosses either. Can't let them hear that, because I think they think I'm about 40. But I'm a lot more comfortable with myself. I think as a 16-year-old, regardless of whatever you've been through, whatever your circumstances are, you're nowhere near ready for everything that life's going to throw at you. You know, you should be out and about doing things and experiencing things and living life, which is, you know, probably what I was doing at the time as well, which was, so there's all these things going around in your head, and then you sort of throw that in the mix, and I'd like to think I'm a lot more able to deal with stuff now, but definitely more so today than I would have been three years ago. Mm. But then again, there's a lot of things going on in my life 3 years ago that most people I think would struggle to deal with.
You know, you look at, you kind of touched on it, but you look at health psychologically, socially, emotionally, physically, financially. You have to keep on top of these things. You have to keep topping it up because when something does happen and it's bad and you had three things, bang, 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 one after another, you don't want to be in crisis. You want to be still in a place where you could still make rational thought. You can recognize the fact and you're humble enough to go, well, actually, I think I might need some professional assistance here. You know, this thing you don't, and that's why daily activities, you know, you talked about it, self-compassion, looking after yourself, understanding that that is really, really important because you can't look after anyone else without looking after yourself. Giving yourself time, giving yourself activities to do, giving yourself things you don't want. It's a great example, you know, that three-legged stool.
Yeah.
Manage yourself in those three ways consistently. What does the future lie with you with two things? Like, one, your health as a whole, but the second thing with is there room for advocacy with regards to psychological health, with talking about this more, with having more open conversations to different communities, that, you know, whether it's fashion and music or whether that's football, where do you want to be with those two things? Like, firstly, with your own health, and then secondly, with supporting others.
I think with my own health, I need to do more from a physical point of view in order to help me mentally. So I need to do more exercise. I need to find some things that I can do to give me that, you know, give me that, make sure I'm still, that stool's still balanced and I'm still and doing what I need to do. Because I've come a little bit sedentary over the last couple of years. And I think that, you know, what we just spoke about in terms of the areas, I think as long as I'm paying attention to those, then I feel pretty good. I feel like I'm, there's always going to be something that comes along. You know, there's always going to be some, like, you know, a fork in the road or something that will, you know, a bit of a test, but hopefully not for, you know, not for some time. But yeah, I feel I'm in a good place with it all. You occasionally have those days where you're like going there, you know, sometimes you just get a bad day and you're like, oh God. And it freaks you out a bit because you're not expecting it, or something might spark it off, and you just, it's that dreadful, horrible feeling. But now I'm, with the experience, I know it's not going to last. I know it's
better equipped,
I know
it's going to
pass. Yeah, yeah. And to answer your other question, I'd like to start doing more things with, I have an Instagram page called Life Jacket UK, it's called, which it just started off as a way of me talking to people on Instagram about my love of clothes, jackets, secondhand clothes, you know, all the things that I've always been into, you know, since you were a young kid, and started collecting more things now. And when I wasn't feeling too good, I'd chat to a lot of people online, and people talk about like the comfort of strangers, and I didn't know a lot of these people. You just, you know, they might be in Italy or they might be in America or wherever, you know, in the world. You just start talking about jackets and this, that and the other, you know, and like sort of like-minded individuals. And I hadn't really thought about the mental health benefits of that until later. And then I started thinking, when I'd done the interview with Panera, I started thinking I can do a bit more with this. And someone came up with this really good line, because I wanted to do some content with it, and I've started doing some interviews with people. I've done one with Noel Gallagher talking about his love of clothes and growing up, because, you know, when he was a young lad, he didn't have cash to go, you know, spending it on Rolls Royces and top end jackets. Not that I've got a Rolls Royce, by the way. you know, he's got a Rolls Royce, he can't even drive.
He can't drive, yeah.
but yeah, so we talked about our shared passion of clothes and his experiences of it and going to football, and you know, and it was just, it's a sort of chat. If you're into what I'm into and what he's into and what a lot of lads, football, music, fashion, then, you know, you'll enjoy it. And so I thought, well, I'll do more of those. And so my plan is I'm going to do some more so content, which will be available on various platforms at some point. It's hard with, because I'm doing Soccer AM, to try and fit everything in, because I want to do it properly. So I'm a bit like, well, if I'm not doing it properly, then I'm not going to do it. So, but I need to just dip my toe in the water with it and crack on, as you know. But I want to do some events whereby people can come down and I'll sit and we'll have a chat and I'll talk a bit about me if people want to hear about me. But more so, I'll get a guest on. I'll get, you know, someone down who's maybe suffered a little bit or not, as the case may be. We just have a chat about their love of the shared interests, you know. But with you know, if wherever possible, we touch upon how people have coped and dealt with their any mental health issues that they've had. But it's not. Let's sit down and talk about mental health. Mm. It's more, let's get all these people, all these lads who are locked in, as in metaphorically, but also, you know, they've been in the house, they've not, with COVID and everything's gone on, but also the sort of people who don't want to get out and then get out of themselves to express and talk. It's more about getting those people out for an evening and we sit around.
Well, a community as well.
And like we people, have the community, yeah, and we call, yeah, come together. And even if we don't talk about, even if we don't talk about mental health at all, the fact that they've come out and had a nice time, and they've met like-minded people, that is, for me, that's a good thing. It's a good thing for their mental health.
We should never underestimate that power of human connection and feeling part of something. You know, that strong social support network, I say it a lot, is one of the key factors in good health, all around good health. John, thank you so much, mate, and we will leave it there.